Welcome to the podcast series for AJP Heart and Circulatory Physiology. I'm your host, Kara Hansel-Keehan. Today, we'll discuss the article by Lee et al. Titled, Membrane Proteomic Profiling of the Heart, Past, Present, and Future. This article was published November 13th, 2020. Joining me today are guest editor Lissandra De Castro-Brash, lead author Anthony Gramolini, and expert Sarah Parker. Let's get started.
Thank you, Tony and Sarah, for joining me today. I'm very excited to have you both in the podcast and to discuss Tony's latest review. So, Tony, your review is focused on the current limitations and the technological advances for the study of membrane protein in cardiomyocytes. In your review, you mentioned that one of the reasons for the lack of or slow progression in the development of therapies for heart disease was coming from the limited number of functional target proteins that are available. That thought was very interesting to me. Can you elaborate on this?
Thanks, Liz. Yes. Until very recently, as we've really just seen in the COVID vaccinations, where they're wrapped in nanoparticles or lipids, getting anything into cells has been difficult. And so affecting any change in cells has required access to and across that cell membrane. Now, my group, along with many others, have been interested in identifying a more complete composition of really what makes up the cell surface of that myocyte. And so studies in the heart and heart cells have had pretty unique technical challenges that haven't really been seen in any other tissues, since heart tissues have been harder to solubilize due to that really strong extracellular matrix. And they really have a very high concentration of mitochondria, which mask any other signals that we really want to get to. So in our review here at AJP, Frank Lee, a senior PhD student in my group, laid out some of the problems and recent proteomic-based work that has attempted to tackle those problems.
Who hates those mitochondria, put their hand in the air. That's me. I completely understand mitochondria are also quite the nuisance in our work. Mitochondria are super important, and I'm very glad there's a lot of labs working on it. But they do are pesky for the ones like us that do not look into bioenergetics. Sarah, do you want to add anything to this?
Yeah, I would add that this limitation really is not necessarily unique to the myocardium alone, and that similar challenges are faced when tackling therapeutics for the arterial system. And in our case, we really see challenges in less abundantly studied conditions relative to things like atherosclerosis, such as aneurysms and dissections. So really being able to understand the cell surface receptors that can bring therapeutic agents into the cell becomes an issue of top importance for translation.
Thank you. One of the major technical challenges with studying cardiac membrane proteins is the isolation of hydrophobic, low abundant proteins. So for our listeners who do not have a strong chemistry background, can you explain some of the differences on study design that you would need to incorporate when studying membrane proteins compared, for example, with nuclear proteins?
So since membrane proteins are hydrophobic, purifying or enriching for them really requires the addition of solubilizing agents such as tween or tritin or NP40. Now, these agents have been fine in standard biochemistry techniques, but they're not historically feasible in mass spectrometry since they tend to clog or contaminate most chromatography columns used in electrospray proteomics, which is what we use. Now, there's a few workarounds that are out there, such as these newer mass spectrometry sort of cleavable detergents, including this PPS silent surfactant, RapiGest, or Protease Max. And these particular reagents can be cleaned up and removed before any mass spectrometry. So they've been a recent great development. And other ways around these membrane proteomic methods have had people performing maybe an additional step somehow between their biochemistry and their mass spectrometry to remove those detergents for any mass spectrometry analysis really starts. And that includes running SDS page gels and cutting out gel bands or gel regions and purifying samples that way. So that addresses that membrane part. And for subcellular isolations, I think they've been a real major consideration in most studies to date. And that really limits sample complexity, which is an essential part for mass spectrometry studies. The last issue to consider is that membrane proteins really represent such a small component of the total protein complement in a cell, less than a few percent. So ultimately, in the end, studying transmembrane spanning proteins has been difficult because they're hard to enrich for the correct organelle. They are expressed at very low levels, and they've been difficult to solubilize.
This really tells us how important it is to go speak with your colleagues that do mass spectrometry before you start your experiment. Because if you do not know that you need to get rid of these detergents, or they are better detergents or a different method, you're just wasting your time. You're going to run your samples hoping that you're going to give them to a core and get all these wonderful data. And they will likely have to tell you, okay, you need to do all these other steps. You might lose some of your protein, or you're going to have to start from scratch.
Yeah, and I would add, Liz, that's such a good point. And there are some really recent exciting advancements coming online now that do detergent removal with very low amounts of input. And they are actually enabling solubilization of cell and tissue lysates with as much as 5% very strong detergents like SDS. So I think there's some hope coming our way in terms of simpler workflows, not just to remove some of the more powerful detergents before mass spectrometry, but to be able to dig down to those very low levels of input when it comes to techniques like organelle enrichment. So there's some exciting times coming our way.
Great. Sarah, from your own experience with the cardiovascular side, is there any other tool rather than mass spectrometry, or even a combination of tools, that could be used reliably to study low abundant proteins?
Well, certainly immunofluorescence and histochemistry is a key alternative when you know the target of interest. While still relying on mass spectrometry, though, there are some other emerging techniques that are showing some exciting progress for context-specific analysis of membrane and other low abundant proteins. So these are tools like tissue CyTOF, where you have metal conjugated antibodies against as many as 100 possible protein targets, and these can then be simultaneously visualized and quantified in situ. So this technology is coming online now in many institutions and offers a lot of promise, again, when you know what targets you want to detect. I think there are other mass spec imaging approaches that are also maturing to enable in situ detection and analysis of proteins in their spatial context, and hopefully one day really dig into the very low abundant proteins. So I guess I look to these mass spec imaging type techniques where I think we're going to see some massive technological growth and hopefully more capability to dig into the bottoms, the low abundance of our proteomes in the next decade.
So one of the issues that I personally believe that leads to misinformation and misinterpretation of data is incorrect or sparse reporting on methodology. It's one of my pet peeves, I would say. Particularly when using cardiac tissues, several studies have reported distinct proteomes depending on sample location. I thought this was very nicely illustrated on your figure 3, Tony, where it's bluntly obvious that when investigating distinct heart regions, there was little and sometimes even no overlap between the identified proteins. Tony, when you're reading a manuscript that seems to have data of interest for you and for your lab, do you look into the method section at all? And if you do, what are the things you specifically look for and what you believe should be reported?
Thanks, Liz. Absolutely. That's a great point. You know, I think, at least for me, right after the results, I do tend to head to the method section. In many ways, I am a fan of some of these newer journals coming online, like Nature Protocols or similar, that are really designed around very clear methods, very clear protocols, and they clearly articulate the finer details or a recipe of that work, and it really is helpful to everyone. Now, what do I look for in particular? I think I expect and appreciate a very clear and thorough description of the work that's done, the equipment that's used, and maybe even importantly, any of those really fine details that are really needed to make sure that that study can be replicated. So I think in other ways, looking forward, what I find in so many journals now is that every journal, I think, allows an expanded supplemental component. And now having that really allows every author to put all of those details, not in the primary aspect of the paper, but at least to get that information out there. And I think that's really important.
Yes, I agree. The proteomes won't lie and they will highlight methodological discrepancies. I firmly believe the methods section should include everything another person would need to replicate your findings. We need this for robustness and reproducibility in our field. I know that I take this to heart and I look to see whether authors have left out key bits of information or other holes in their methods that would prevent my lab or another team from replicating a technique or approach that led them to their observations. I think that sometimes authors also breeze over the simple details of how they dissected their tissues and got from intact material to their proteins ready for analysis.
Thank you, Sarah. So now I have a brainstorming question for both of you, maybe a little bit sci-fi, hopefully not. It's definitely on my wish list. So do you have any thoughts on how mass spectrometry can be developed to allow for real-time temporal proteome profiling?
That is such an essential question right now. I think for the most part, most groups haven't had access to the equipment or the resources to do anything remotely close to what we could call sort of a real-time temporal proteome. There really are very, very few studies that have even tried anything remotely close to following a disease over multiple time points in great detail. Now, I think that some of the hardware coming online will allow, I think, more appropriate real-time type studies. And the leaders in really the mass spec field pushing those limits, which include Rudy Abersold and Matthias Mann, have really shown us that they can get faster sample analysis with greater depth and even less sample. And so I actually think in the fairly near future, we should be able to envision studies that do take these detailed approaches to looking at lots of samples with multiple time points in real extreme detail. And to me, that at least should be something that will be called a real-time temporal aspect of a proteome profile.
And to add to that, Tony, this is actually already kind of being done with technologies like the ion knife. So far, the focus of this technology has been on using metabolites to outline the profile of tumors during active surgery. We could see applications where the similar technology could be used to study proteins. Of course, this will rely on having surgical access to the tissue, but it provides a means to monitor proteomes in living human tissues in real time. I think another intriguing direction could be imaging techniques using various affinity probes and reporter molecules to monitor abundance of a protein or a post-translational state in vivo over time. How we apply mass spectrometry to that would be much more of a tricky question. But Liz, you asked for some science fiction. So I'm a scientist and I'll engage in some fictional thinking, perhaps some crazy combination of an affinity probe that binds to a membrane protein in its native or post-translationally modified state could be coupled with reporter molecules that circulate through the bloodstream for collection and monitoring then by mass spectrometry. I think with cardiovascular proteomes, tackling real-time monitoring using a destructive technology like mass spectrometry is so hard, but there are creative ways to envision getting there one day with the right engineering collaborations.
I have a final question for you too. Where does the field go from here? Meaning, in your mind, what are the real opportunities or challenges for proteome discovery?
I think that some great labs right now have been pushing forward around advanced post-translational modifications. I think that's going to be where we need to be in the next few years. And I think developing real integrated artificial intelligence, AI-based analysis of all of this new data that's being generated really globally will be two areas that I think will be moving forward extremely valuable to the entire field. But I think from my perspective, one of the other major challenges that we have is as all of this data, there's massive amounts of data now being generated and being made publicly available. How do we analyze it? How do we actually bring that to the next stage? And so I think that is probably one of the other major limits where we need to focus on is how do we actually take all this data and meaningfully move it forward?
Tony, that's such a good point. I agree 100%. And I think for me, I go back to spatial proteomics, the idea of being able to delineate the abundance of large numbers of proteins, not just in these bulk homogenates that we work with, but within their intact spatial context. I think this can also include the goal of single cell proteomics, which is seeing real growth and possibilities right now. And I think it's going to be a major growth area for our future. I know several labs are pushing hard to bring single cell proteomics online. It has severe challenges in the limits of detection that proteomics have. But I think this is going to provide really orthogonal molecular insight to some of the single cell RNA sequencing data sets and approaches that have already gained a lot of traction in different areas of research.
And with this, I would like to thank Tony Grammolini and Sarah Parker for joining me for this podcast and providing all this information, a lot of thought to process, and I had a lot of fun. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks for listening. Would you like to hear more? Visit the AJP Heart and Circulatory Physiology homepage for our latest episodes.